Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 14th of May. Pakistan will defeat the Taliban militarily, but could lose the public relations war if it fails to help the hundreds of thousands of people displaced by the fighting. The Prime Minister of Pakistan made that announcement today. At least 830,000 people have fled from their homes, joining more than 500,000 displaced by earlier fighting in the northwest. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, visiting a camp for the displaced, said that Pakistan needs massive international help to avert a tragedy. The New York Times today in its editorial says that the war in Afghanistan is not going well, that continued Taliban gains would bring even greater suffering to the Afghan people, and it would mean wider sanctuaries for terrorists who are plotting attacks against the United States and Europe, and even greater instability in Pakistan. Joining us this hour to talk about all of this is Shuja Nawaz, who is director of the South Asia Center, Atlantic Council of the United States, and author of a number of books, most recently Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He has headed three separate divisions of the International Monetary Fund. He has worked all over the world and has been in the Ministry of Planning and Development for the government of Pakistan, advisor to the minister, and has produced a study of economic information flows and how to improve them in Pakistan. Also worked for the International Atomic Energy Agency. His list goes on. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Shuja Nawaz, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start with this refugee situation? We have over a million people who have been displaced by fighting in the northwest, and the UN High Commissioner is calling for a massive amount of international help to avert a tragedy. It's a real humanitarian crisis. Who's dealing with it? Who needs to deal with it?
Well, the government is trying to do something, but they didn't plan for this, unfortunately. Neither did they plan for the earlier attack in the agency named Bajor, where 300,000 people were displaced before the military went in to clear out the militants. So they had to play catch-up. There are a limited number of sites where people are being registered. The majority of the internally displaced people, or refugees, if you want to call them that, are really on their own or trying to cope by going with relatives or friends or going to the larger cities. The UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, is registering as many as it can, but the numbers just seem to be growing with the intensity of the fighting.
Mm-hmm. And when I was looking at these figures this morning, it's fairly striking to me. Maybe it's a misprint or something. There are 15,000 members of security forces facing about only 5,000 militants in the SWAT region particularly. That's a real difference of army power. Why is the Taliban making such significant gains here?
Well, nobody really knows the exact number of the Taliban fighters.
Mm.
I have not seen any authoritative statements from the government or the inter-services intelligence. If they do have a number, they don't obviously want to share it. So all these are guesstimates. A couple of months ago, when speaking to a former head of the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, he said there are 100,000 Taliban. Now, these could be Taliban sympathizers or they could all be fighters. Of course, many people in that part of the country do carry their own guns. So they can certainly be brought to fight. But I suspect that the number is somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000, which is the hardcore fighting. And they, because they are in the towns and in the cities, it's very difficult to separate them from the general population. And that's why you have one division of the Pakistan Army enhanced recently with another brigade. You're talking of 15,000 plus, close to 20,000 soldiers using artillery, using tanks, using helicopter gunships in order to clear them out. But it's a very difficult fight because it's a counterinsurgency, and the Pakistan Army is not trained for that. It's a conventional force.
Mm-hmm. And what about the change of command here in the United States, the administration's decision to replace David McKiernan with Stanley McChrystal, who evidently has a background in aggressive counterinsurgency? Is this a wise move? Does it make that much difference who's at the top?
Well, there were a couple of reasons, according to my understanding, for the change in Afghanistan. Number one, it consolidates the position of the commander. There wasn't a comprehensive command structure in Afghanistan. General McKiernan had taken over, but apparently had not shown an ability to manage all the aspects of the battles going on in Afghanistan. And the worst criticism of him that appears to have surfaced is that he was a very conventional military man. He thought in very conventional terms, whereas the situation demands very unconventional thinking. And General McChrystal obviously has had a lot of background in that through special forces, and he's likely to be infectious in the approach in which he takes, so that the rest of his commanders will learn from him.
Mm. And infectious in terms of moving the Pakistani army in a less conventional direction as well?
Well, unfortunately, there is no communication between the commander in Afghanistan and the Pakistan army directly. This is one of the gaps that exists in that theater of war. So we probably will not have a lot of formal interaction. However, I suspect as the tripartite discussions continue, which involves the United States, the Afghan defense minister, and the head of the Pakistan army on a monthly basis, that General McChrystal will be able to play a role in dealing with his counterpart in Pakistan and help educate them.
And the reason there has not been direct communication previously is what?
Because these were totally different theaters of war. Afghanistan was treated quite separately from Pakistan, even though both areas come under the jurisdiction of CENTCOM, and because there are no troops, U.S. troops in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the number of civilian casualties. How many have there been, and does this, and has it, made people more likely to join with the Taliban?
The number of casualties overall since the fighting began is very hard to determine. But the number of casualties that have been associated with one particular activity that has certainly helped the recruitment of people into the Taliban, and I'm referring now to the drone attacks.
Yes.
That the United States has used effectively in the last 6 months, in particular in the border region known as FATA, the federally administered tribal area. The drone attacks have killed a very small number of Al-Qaeda operatives and their associates, but has managed to kill something like 700 civilians as collateral damage. So that's a very high proportion compared to the actual targets of the bomb attacks from the drones. And each drone attack, when it kills civilians, has been used by the Taliban to enhance their recruitment. I wrote a paper that was released in January this year for the Center for Strategic and International Studies called FATA, A Most Dangerous Place, in which I quoted the leader of the Pakistani Taliban movement, a man named Baitullah Masood, in which he said that I spent 3 months wandering around trying to recruit people, and I could just get a handful. And one drone attack, and I suddenly had something like 150 recruits.
Hmm.
So that has been a key factor.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit more about the resources that we've spent. When we talk about 7 years here, 7 years in Afghanistan particularly, it seems to me as though things are not going very well, that they should have been going in the opposite direction, and instead we have a worsening situation. There has been criticism that we just didn't put enough money into Afghanistan particularly, that the money was diverted to Iraq, and as a result we've lost ground continually in Afghanistan. Would you agree with that? I don't know if it does us any good to talk about that now, but is that one of the reasons that we've been doing so miserably over 7 years? 7 years is a long time.
Yes, indeed, Kathleen. And actually, it goes it goes back to even before that, when the United States decided to launch Operation Enduring Freedom, which was the name for the attack on Afghanistan. There was no comprehensive strategy. There was no real aim except somehow to get rid of the Taliban and in the process perhaps to kill or capture the Al-Qaeda leadership. But the way it was handled was not with the quantum of force that was required, and the fact that there was aerial bombardment as the primary tool made it a very ineffective operation. Also, the United States used some of its Northern Alliance allies to try and shut off some of the escape routes of the Al-Qaeda leadership into Pakistan. That part turned out to be a serious error because Afghanistan is a tribal society, and the Northern Alliance belonged to a very different ethnic group and different tribes, and they got almost no support from the local tribes. As a result, a very small number of special forces was used to try and block a very large border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Pakistan Army was asked, but at a late stage, to try and block the border, but it's a 1,500-kilometer border, almost 1,000 miles, of very rugged terrain, and you really cannot seal it permanently. And so that's where the Al-Qaeda leadership left. The Taliban, of course, melted away into the population or across the border into Pakistan to their own fellow tribals in some cases, and sought refuge there and couldn't be traced. And then soon after that, the United States decided to launch operations in Iraq, and the whole emphasis shifted, by which time any effort that could have been made to help rebuild Afghanistan, to help the population, to win them over, that opportunity was totally lost. And so we've really spent the last 6 years or 7 years trying to make up for that. And it's only in the last couple of years that the emphasis has moved back to Afghanistan.
Right. And we had heard promising reports of women going to school and educational opportunities opening again. And I'd like for you to address those particular issues. We've had problems with aid workers being killed, schools being bombed, women being burned. Is Yes. that increasing now in Afghanistan? And why? We seem to have a better handle on that a few years ago, didn't we?
Well, a lot is happening on the ground, which is good, but a lot needs to happen, a lot more needs to happen. And the part that was missed out and is only now picking up steam was the building up of local capacity for providing security to the Afghan population. If you have a strong police force and an Afghan military which is embedded in the population, then it isolates the militants. It prevents them from coming in and coercing the local population into doing what they wanted to do. And that is the key. And it's only now picking up steam, and it'll probably be another 3 to 4 years before a reasonable number of Afghan police and military can provide security, and then the United States can concentrate on other things like building the economy and the infrastructure and so on.
3 to 4 years.
Definitely. In fact, we at the Atlantic Council recently at my center, the South Asia Center, released a report with a 10-year framework, with an implementation plan, which will take 10 years because there has to be a long-term goal and then certain short and medium-term goals that you can achieve as you head to the long-term goal to make Afghanistan a fully functioning and effective democracy and an economy. It's not going to be done overnight, but their schools have reopened. They have to be protected now, and maybe the increase of U.S. troops and the nominal increase of some of the NATO forces will likely help if they are concentrated on those areas where the Taliban are most active, and they can clear those areas and then hold them. The critical thing is whether they will have local support in holding them.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. We'll take them in a moment. We have a lot on the plate here this morning. We're talking about the escalating violence in Pakistan between government troops and Taliban militants, the huge number of people who have been displaced as a result of this, the war in Afghanistan, the change in command, and a new command that look with somebody who's very well trained in counterinsurgency tactics. Our guest welcomes that change. And a situation that just isn't going very well and keeps getting worse. Well, if you want to take on the drone attacks and the killing of civilians and whether or not we need to change a strategy so that won't happen, I guess that's a given. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email for our guests, the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Shujaan Nawaz is our guest, director of the South Asia Center Atlantic Council of the United States and author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He writes for leading newspapers and the Huffington Post and speaks on current topics before civic groups at think tanks and all over radio and television. He's worked on projects with RAND, the United States Institute of Peace, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and more. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program, we'll talk about The Moth. It's a New York group that's dedicated to promoting the art of storytelling. It's coming to Milwaukee in June. Andy Borowitz is going to be with us, online columnist, political humorist. His work appears in The New Yorker and The New York Times, and we'll also be speaking with the executive and creative director of The Moth. They're looking for great storytellers, actually, in this area, so we'll tell you how you can join that competition as well. And they're going to have a presence on Wisconsin Public Radio in the months ahead. Two phone calls now. We have lines open if you'd like to speak with Shujaan Nawaz. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jake is our first caller from Menasha. Hi, Jake.
Yes, good morning. I've been listening to your program, and I've often wanted to ask this question about the Middle East to someone that seems to be very knowledgeable. In my opinion, the U.S.'s foreign policy in the Middle East over the last half century, has been a complete failure. What would the guest recommend we change to make things work in the Middle East?
That's a big question, Mr. Nawaz.
Well, it is a big question. If it wasn't a big question, probably somebody would have solved it by now. I don't know if my suggestion is going to help resolve it, but the approach that President Obama appears to be taking seems to be headed in the right direction, in that he has appointed a very highly respected individual who has had success in Northern Ireland in mediating between two very difficult parties. So that's a good beginning. The question of recognizing the rights and responsibilities of both sides is critical in this, so that the United States is not seen as tilting one way or the other. A very difficult problem that the U.S. will need to overcome is its relationship with Hamas. When it did get elected and the U.S. was unable to recognize it, because it felt that it was not a legitimate political body. Yet the U.S. supported the election. So there has to be some consistency in the position of the United States vis-a-vis elections, and perhaps a greater awareness of the proper sequencing of events. So if we push for elections in areas where societies haven't settled down yet, then you will get results that you may feel are unacceptable. On the Israeli side, the United States has to find a way to get Israel to accept the idea of the two-state approach. And we have a new government there which has internal debate on this issue, so we'll have to see how that emerges. As I said, it's a complicated problem, almost like an onion with many layers, and it's a question of gradually peeling them one by one.
You have a follow-up, Jake? Or
what would you think in terms of a time frame?
It's impossible to set time frames for such negotiations. You really have to allow the participants time to absorb each other's point of view. And for mediators, you have to create an enabling environment, one of confidence in your ability to help ensure whatever result they come up with is practicable and will be implemented. I think the United States, for many years, was seen as being more favored towards Israel, and it has to somehow overcome that and bring the Arabs on board, whereas particularly the Palestinians now are critical to this solution, and since they're now a party to the discussion, I think Senator Mitchell is likely to achieve greater success than all his predecessors.
Thank you, Jake, very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. We have an email. We've had long enough to get bin Laden and his criminal gang. That's why we went to Afghanistan, not to make sure that girls can go to school. Get out now before we're the new Soviets, and don't we need the money here at home? From Dave from Madison.
Well, that is a very relevant point, and I'm sure a lot of Americans are thinking along those lines. The question is, the reality on the ground is that the United States and its allies are in Afghanistan, and it's not easy to pack up and leave when the country is in turmoil. This will be only fulfilling the worst fears of the population in Afghanistan and in neighboring countries like Pakistan, that the U.S. Is a very fickle ally, comes in and then departs suddenly when it is distracted or something else is happening elsewhere, either at home or in other parts of the world. I think this is an opportunity for the United States to show that it is willing to help a country regain its footing. Now, obviously, nation building is something that has to be done by the nations themselves. But again, I use the term enabling environment. You're trying to give them the wherewithal that they can do the things that they need to do to have a functioning government. I think the United States and the European allies are likely to be in Afghanistan for much longer, but not in a military sense. I think there will be economic associations that are going to help Afghanistan and the region. And so the new regional approach that is being taken involving Iran and the Central Asian states and Pakistan and India and maybe Russia and China is likely to bear some fruit, which will allow the United States to withdraw its military forces. In terms of the actual monies spent on Afghanistan, when compared with Iraq, which many people felt was the unnecessary war, it's a very small fraction that was spent in Afghanistan. And if that kind of money that was used in Iraq had been spent on Afghanistan in the first 4 or 5 years, the results would have been much more spectacular.
And what are the current economic associations? Are there many? Are there any?
Inside the country or in the region?
In the region.
In the region, there are a number of overlapping economic regional organizations. There is something called the Economic Cooperation Organization that involves Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan. There's something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that involves all the countries of the Central Asian region and China and Russia. And you also have Pakistan as an observer there. And for the first time this year, the United States attended as an observer. So there are a number of other organizations that arose out of the successor states of the Soviet Union. The economies of the countries in the region are interlinked. For instance, one major project that was on the table and that, in fact, we are now reviving at the Atlantic Council was the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India pipeline for oil and gas. That kind of interaction allows countries to benefit from each other. And Afghanistan, of course, would get a lot of transit fees from any pipelines or land traffic that goes across its land into the other countries. There's also the Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline. That is on hold because the U.S. has sanctions against Iran, so no multinational will want to be involved in it. Otherwise, it will be blacklisted by the U.S.
Let's go to Bruce from Duluth next. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Is it true that the Taliban gets a great percentage of their funding from opium sales? And what about a consideration of saying, well, we would have a nationwide purchase of raw opium from the farmers to engender local support, and then over the course of 10 years have a sliding scale where our price that we would pay for opium would go down as our investment in the local communities would go up?
That's a very good idea, and in fact, it has been discussed at different levels internationally and in Afghanistan, question of buying the crop so that the local farmer at least has some income. Another approach which was extremely successful in Pakistan, if you recall, Pakistan at one time was an opium grower in that same border region that abuts Afghanistan. But there was a tremendous effort made by the Narcotics Assistance Section of the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad working with the Pakistanis, and they created alternative jobs for the locals so that they had alternative sources of income and therefore did not need to grow the poppy. And so today Pakistan has zero poppy growth. That approach would probably be highly effective in Afghanistan also. If you open up the countryside with infrastructure investments, roads and bridges and small dams, which would employ the local population and also allow them to move their other produce to market easily. The other immediate approach, which has been discussed among others the new commanders in Afghanistan, has been to attack the refining facilities rather than the poppy fields. Because eradication of poppy is a very difficult job, whereas eradication of the refining facilities is relatively simpler. And once you've identified the areas where they are, you can attack them and destroy them, and you hurt the industry much more that way. So there are different approaches, and they probably all have to be done simultaneously.
And what are those alternative jobs that would be as lucrative as growing opium?
Well, growing opium for the farmers is not as lucrative as it appears to us. It's the final processed product that becomes very lucrative. The value added comes there. And the poor farmer doesn't get that. He only gets a very limited amount. And Ashraf Ghani, who was the finance minister of Afghanistan and who was the author of the study that I mentioned earlier, a 10-year framework for Afghanistan that we published at the Atlantic Council last month, has actually done very precise calculations of the price points at which alternative crops become viable as a replacement for opium for the farmers. So we know exactly what can be done. When I mentioned the creation of infrastructure, roads and bridges and all that, this is the kind of employment that can immediately generate jobs for large numbers of Afghans.
Thank you, Bruce, very much for your call. Dan is next from Franksville. Hi, Dan. Dan?
Howdy.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think that the policy in America, as someone called up earlier and says that it was a failure. I really don't think it's a failure because I think, you know, there's enough money to get done what you want done. You know, if you want oil pump, Chevron wants to pump oil across Afghanistan, whatever. I mean, you look where America's been, where they spent a lot of money, say Nicaragua, where they were there trying to improve democracy. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. They spent tons of time in Haiti. That's a basket case. Everywhere they go, they want free markets. That means that you run the country into the ground, then investors come in, they buy up everything that's good, all the good lands, beaches, lakefronts or whatever. And the populace works for the corporations, international corporations. I mean, they rule the world. They got their lobbyists in Washington. And so although they haven't met all their objectives that they wanted to, the plans are going pretty well.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the caller's position. Is he saying that the multinational corporations are a good thing or a bad thing?
A bad thing.
I see. Well, the approach that seems to be working to some extent in parts of Afghanistan has been to start at the other end, which is from the community upwards. Of course, they have opened some of the national activities such as telecommunications and cell phone systems to companies, but some of the companies are Afghan companies or are partnerships with foreign companies. There are no large multinationals in Afghanistan other than those kinds of firms. Most of the development work is being done through community-based grants and assistance. And in the areas where there is security, they are being quite effective because that's the way to build up local capacity. And that's the way to avoid the kind of situation that the caller is referring to, where you have essentially carpetbaggers coming in and taking over.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. More phone calls in just one moment as we talk about Pakistan and Afghanistan and looking at a situation that's not going very well in either country. We have looked at the replacement of General David McKiernan with Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal, who has a background in aggressive counterinsurgency tactics. We're looking at civilian deaths as a result of drone predators. We're talking about economic development for both countries, long-term plans, why it hasn't gone very well, and what needs to happen to lessen the violence and increase employment, etc. So our guest is Shuja Nawaz, and he knows a whole lot about what's going on in this part of the world. He is the director of the South Asia Center, the Atlantic Council of the United States, author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He has worked with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. He has worked with the World Health Organization, the New York Times, where he was a writer, and also works with Pakistan Television. We'll have to ask him about that. Author of a number of other books, including a book of verse, and he has written extensively on all of these issues. Back to phone calls in a moment. Couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we talk about storytelling and this project that has really taken off, storytelling in New York and also in Los Angeles, but it's coming to Milwaukee. Well, it's coming today to Milwaukee, and it will be a part of Wisconsin Public Radio a little bit later. We will speak with the creative editor of The Moth and Andy Borowitz, who's going to be moderating the Moth's show here in the city of Milwaukee. All of that's coming up the second hour of our program. All right, back to phone calls. Let's go next to Paul from West Bend. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. If we were not in Afghanistan, the European Union forces would not be there. I mean, we have to coerce them to put in a token troop levels there. And I can't understand why Afghanistan is in our national interest. Remember, friendships rule that out. It's national interest. They have no resources whatsoever, and we are an ocean away, and we could profile terrorists, and we are going bankrupt over there, and we're never going to solve the problem because we're not going to be able to create a functioning state over there unless you want to move in teachers, civil engineers, electrical engineers, everything that an advanced society needs.
Well, these are all very valid concerns. The Europeans and the United States are there not just for military reasons, but for economic and political reasons, too. And the most immediate one was to try and eliminate the area as a base for international terrorism. To the extent that the United States rousted the Taliban from power and eliminated them as a base for Al-Qaeda, it has succeeded, but the fact that that border region offers refuge for Al-Qaeda and continues to offer refuge for them and the Taliban, that threat still remains. It's not just for the countries in the region, but for the globe as a whole. With the pressure of U.S. Forces, as well as, to some extent, the Pakistani forces in the area, Al-Qaeda has really not been able to launch any major attack at the international level. And I think in that sense, something went right. Now, the question is, if you were to abandon Afghanistan yet again, there is a danger that you may have the Taliban resurging, and a danger that, again, Al-Qaeda would have a state that would provide it support and sustenance and protection and a base for its operations. And then whenever they are successful in launching another major attack on Europe or on the United States, you would have to rethink about the decision to leave the area. Much more dangerous now than Afghanistan, to some extent, is the situation is in Pakistan, because the backdraft of the expulsion of the Taliban from Afghanistan into Pakistan has created a Taliban movement inside Pakistan. And Pakistan is a nuclear state with 60 to 70 nuclear weapons and developing more. If for any reason this movement takes a hold in Pakistan, you run the risk of a destabilized country of 180 million people with nuclear weapons in the hands of very radical Islamists. And the consequences of that for the region and the world may be much worse than anything that we've dreamt about for Afghanistan.
Hmm. And yet, having said what you just said, isn't the Taliban experiencing a resurgence now, even though we've been trying to fight them for maybe not full force for 7 years?
Well, the Taliban has certainly found a lot of support in Pakistan, and one of the reasons for that was the drone attacks. This is the last 2 or 3 years that they've been surging. The Tehrik-e-Taliban of Pakistan, the TTP, the local movement, only began 2 years ago.
Thanks, Paul, very much for the call. Let's go to Nasser from Libertyville, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I just would like to make two quick comments, please, and then would like to hear the comments of the guest on that. The first issue, actually, that I think is that Pakistani civilians could be a very strong force against Taliban's there. But I think that the mistrust that is present in many Pakistanis against United States foreign policy is making them very skeptical to even the sincere efforts of the United States. So I think that the adjustment in foreign policy will need to be addressed in order to gain the trust of Pakistani people. And what happens actually is that this mistrust, along with, as your guest mentioned, the drone attacks, and also the some elements actually in Pakistan get these recruits against working with Taliban. And I think that since U.S. has labeled all the madrasas to be bad, I think that U.S. need to really differentiate between the good madrasas and the bad madrasas. And U.S. should support, actually, the good scholars who would actually go and basically fight against these extremist people and tell them that their stand is wrong. And I'll take my feedback, actually, please.
Okay.
Thank you. That's a very good point, and I entirely agree with the caller. In fact, the madrasa question has been overblown, and it's very misunderstood. A madrasa is basically a school, and because the public education system failed to provide opportunities for kids to be educated, the madrasas have been filling that gap. The question is, how large a problem, if it is a problem, is this? The actual number of madrasas that have been associated with the Taliban movement or that were associated previously in the 80s with the Mujahideen movement against the Soviet Union were very small and in a very restricted area. They are a fraction of the total number of madrasas throughout the country. And registering madrasas, bringing them into the mainstream by allowing them not only to teach religious topics, but also to equip students with much more worldly knowledge so that they can get jobs in the marketplace is the way. And I think gradually a move is occurring in that direction. The caller also made another very good point, which is that you need to be able to use Islamic scholarship within the society to challenge and rebut the claims of the Taliban and the radical militants that are often using Islam in a very cynical manner for political purposes. And often when they use terms like Sharia, which is sort of Islamic tradition, they are really employing a very convoluted definition of Sharia, and that it is quite often a mixture of old tribal customs and some misinterpretation of Islamic rules and regulations. So you have to challenge them, and I entirely agree that the answer lies in Pakistani society. I mentioned earlier Pakistan has a population of close to 180 million people. About 30 million plus are the middle class, with an average per capita income of $10,000 based on purchasing power parity. This is a very powerful middle class with a powerful political and economic base that can transform the country, and in fact has been transforming the country in spite of very poor government over the years. I'll give you another set of figures. The World Bank recently completed a study of developing countries in the period 1980 to 2007. And came to the conclusion that there were two countries that had the highest per capita growth rates. And the answer will surprise you. Number one was not surprising, China, at 9.9% average growth rate. Number two was Pakistan at 5.8%. During a period when we had an autocratic military government, which was not very effective in running the country and helping the people, but the economy moved on because the people were still hard at work. So there are great opportunities if the people of Pakistan are given a chance to manage their affairs. And the U.S. is now, I'm glad to see, being in Washington, working with people in the White House and talking to people on the Hill, both in, parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, people on the Hill and in the administration are now looking for a longer-term relationship with the people of Pakistan, not with any individual or party or a group. I think that's where they will be able to rebuild trust, because otherwise the people of Pakistan tend to have very long memories, and they look at the roller coaster relationship between Pakistan and the United States, where the U.S. comes in, when there is an issue in the region and then departs suddenly and then Pakistan is left holding the bag. I think that's going to be changing with the new Kerry Lugar bill, Congressman Berman's bill, and President Obama's own strategy for Pakistan.
Thank you very much for your call. I'm interested in your background. I know this was a while ago in the late 60s as a Pakistani television news guy. I'm interested in how the news is getting to people in Pakistan and how all of this is being covered. I don't have any familiarity with that.
Well, Kathleen, you're taking me back many decades into a previous century. I was very lucky. I was a young man working for Pakistan Television when it started in Pakistan.
Oh.
I was still in college and began working in the news side and was presenting the English news every evening while I was in my early 20s, which offered me a great opportunity to grow with the medium. And at that time, there was only one television corporation, the official government channel, and we had four stations which weren't even networked. We used to fly those big, fat videotapes around the country to get our programs copied and broadcast simultaneously. Well, today, Pakistan has something like 62 television channels, and it's news around the clock with breaking news every 2 minutes, it seems. There is a tremendous amount of FM radio. The country is just peppered with information, and I think the market will have to clear so that there's likely to be 10 or 12 major channels that will emerge. But it's a very active process. People are getting a lot of their information from the television and from the global TV and the Internet. The youth in Pakistan are like the youth anywhere. They are much more adept and tuned into the world, which is why their expectations are very high, which is why if governments do not deliver, you have civil society in Pakistan coming out on the streets and making even very powerful presidents like Musharraf resign.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Barbara from Milwaukee. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted, first of all, to say that how much I admire the Afghani people, that their history is something that everyone should read. They've been always a very independent state, and they've gone through a lot. I feel bad that we didn't stay in Afghanistan. That's where we should have been. We should never have been in Iraq. And the gentleman is very right. If we had done what we should have done in Afghanistan, we'd be 100 years away from where we are now. And I appreciate the conversation that's going on, all of it. And I agree totally that we have to absolutely help the Afghan people change their agricultural crop and all the other things he talked about. As far as the whole idea that we do, you know, we've spent money other places and how can we afford to do this, my answer is we can afford not to.
Thank you very much for the call, Barbara. Would you like to respond, Shuja Nawaz?
Yes, I just want to add that a lot of people, in fact, forget that Afghanistan has been a state and a country for much longer than most of the other countries in the region. They've been around for almost 200 years. And although there are ethnic divisions and the geography of the country sort of has split it in three or four different segments, they have managed to work together as a national entity, and the Afghans have a local term which they call Misak-e-Milli, which is a compact of the population of the country, that they basically agreed to balance each other off by having previously a king at the center in Kabul, who was a kind of a political glue holding them together, but was not a very powerful central commanding figure. And as a result, the various regions balanced each other off. What the United States did not realize when it went in was that it allowed Mr. Karzai to try and set up a very strong, centrally controlled government. And there's been resistance to that from the provinces. I think now Mr. Karzai is realizing it and forming alliances for his next election. But in the end, Afghanistan will survive because the people have a tremendous spirit, and they're very hardworking, and they have great resources, many of which have been untapped. For instance, the United States has done a geological survey of the country, and there are these fantastic maps that show incredible mineral deposits throughout the country.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for being with us. It was really a good hour. I appreciate your being with us, Shoshana
Nawaz.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll talk to you again, I hope. Shoshana Nawaz is director of the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council of the United States and author of Crossed Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios. We return with another hour shortly following the news here on the Ideas Network.